Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And it's best of week here. Sean Carey, the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Chris Soleri, Detroit Free Press, coming up next half hour. We'll recap the Villanova-Michigan college basketball national championship game from early April. Chris was courtside for that. Looking forward to tomorrow as well. Tony Knopp, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, Friday. One of the great interviews we've ever had on this show in its history, Mike Reed. We'll replay that from September of 2016. Also, it's awesome when we get this guy to join Steve. They have been friends for decades. Of course, we've heard him on the radio and on TV in the booth. And it was just so great that he was there a decade ago to finally witness a World Series win. It was just too long in between championships between 1980 and 2008. Now an ambassador for the Philadelphia Phillies, the one and only Wheels, Chris Wheeler.
Nice to be with you, Steve, and to hear you mention my name with you and Mike Reed is outstanding. Very nice.
We had a good time, though, all of us. Yeah. Brian, everybody did.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, Brian, our good friend from Clearwater, was up also, and that was a great day. You know, as you know, and as I kept saying to you, it was so cool to walk on that field again. It'd been a long time since I'd ever done that, and to stand there on that beautiful afternoon and watch that scrimmage and talk football with you, and then to be in the company of the great Mike Reed was it was just really special. The whole day was really special.
It really was, and I mean, you follow the program closely. What were a couple of impressions you got in watching this play out?
Well, you know, and it continues to impress me the last few years, Steve, is the athleticism now. And for obvious reasons, with the increase in scholarships, with the way they've been able to recruit, with the quality of kids they've been able to recruit and bring in there, and the depth. One of the first things I see when I walk out of the tunnel before I even ran into you, I walk to my left a little bit, and there are all these offensive linemen starting their drills. And just to see the size and the athleticism of the offensive linemen. And, you know, like I have to tell you what a problem that was 2-3 years ago, or when Bill O'Brien even came in, you know, what they had to do to rebuild the offensive line. So that was one of the first things that jump out at you. And then you watch the drills they go through, and then you watch the live contact and everything. And you look out there and you see Micah Parsons wearing that number 11, and watch him move around and the way they're moving him around. And it just the overall and just the energy that they have, and the Coach Franklin has himself, and that the assistants have. And it was just it's just fun to be around the program and be lucky enough to be able to get as close to it as I'm able to get.
No question. Let's talk baseball for a few moments here, and one of them would be I want to talk about the fact that it seems that there is an impression that baseball has become a result of three: walk, strikeout, home run. Now, you and I know there's a lot more to it than that, but you and I both know that is a trend. What are you thinking now as you watch games?
Bothers me because you're right. You know, there's so much attention paid now to working they didn't call it working the count, you know, of getting ahead in situations, of taking pitches, of working the pitcher, trying to get the starter out of the game. The strikeouts, they don't seem to care anymore. You still hear people say, well, an out, a strikeout's just an out. Well, it's not. It's not just an out, because when you make an out and you make contact, something can happen. The other thing that drives me nuts are the shifts, and I understand why you have to do it, but I think the strikeouts and the pitchers that strike so many people out now out of the bullpen and the fact of the shifts cause games not to have that many base runners late in the game. And that's when games should be won or lost, or from the sixth inning on, the seventh, eighth, and ninth. And the seventh, eighth, and ninth, because of the way the game is evolving, has turned into just kind of standing around and not much happening, because you bring all these guys out of the bullpen, these situation guys, and a lot of them are strikeout guys, so obviously nothing happens there. And then they put the ball in play, and they got three guys standing there. And everybody says, well, slap it the other way. Well, that's not going to happen. That's not the way the game is played nowadays. So it does bother me. It does worry me, because we're in an age right now where people want constant action in everything. Gosh, I'm walking around campus. You'll appreciate this because you teach. I'm walking around campus and everybody's banging into you because they got their heads in their phones all the time. And that's what you're dealing with right now, is this constant instant gratification. And baseball is not going to be a game of instant gratification. It's not built that way. It's not going to be that way. So I worry about it. I worry about it in the future. But for those of us who love it, and you and I are two of those people, we understand the nuances of the game. There's still plenty of them, and it's still a great game to watch. But I think some of the things they're doing right now that people say, you know, are, well, they're trends. No, they're not trends. I think this is the way the game is headed, to do the kind of things that we're just talking about with all the pitch taking of pitches and all the walks and all the strikeouts and the shifts. That I think it's kind of overall detrimental to the game, in my opinion, as a spectator sport.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And again, you and I will keep going because we love the game and we love the nuances. But you can't grow the game if you're not getting younger people to quote, think along the same lines that we do.
Yeah, and you know, it's not like they're not trying. I mean, they're very, very involved. And very, like, I'm retired basically now, and that sounds weird to say it, but I was around the club this spring, and I've been around it the last 4 years that I've been off the air. And the number of, two of the biggest increases in hirings in our organization are in the analytics department, obviously, because you hear a lot about that, but also in social media. We have a lot of young kids there that they have to, you know, I sat with them and they explained it to me what they're doing. They're always taking pictures. They're always typing stuff on their phone. And they say how they're sending this instant stuff out all the time about when things happen with your organization, with your team, during the game, before the game, after the game. And people want that. And the young people really want that. So I've never been one to be an old fossil and say, well, you know, you can't roll the punches a little bit. But there's a lot going on right now that I really don't understand. And the little bit that I'm around, and now I try to ask a lot of questions, because I've always felt that's the way you learn something anyway, is to ask questions. But it is a huge, huge seismic shift in the way that the game itself is being presented. And look, I have to think that every sport is that way. That you would see what's happening with college football and a lot of the. We're talking the other day about instant replays and everything, how it seems like there's so many of them in college football. But I think some of it for our game, you can't be left behind, and you have to try to appeal to young people, and they're trying their best to do it. But I don't know, with the way the game is being played right now, if that's going to be successful.
Well, I'll give you an example. At one point, and I think it was before you and Brian walked over, I was standing with Mike Reed in the end zone, and suddenly someone came up and they said, hey, we need to get some shots for social media. We're going to put this up on Twitter and Facebook and everything like that. So they got pictures of Mike because that was their job. That's what they had to do. And so just in a setting such as that, where you and I are there to observe a scrimmage, social media had to record that Mike was there because it was important to them.
Exactly. And that's what we have so much of now in our organization, and I'm sure in every organization. We had these young kids in spring training, and they're very young, too, which is the way it should be, because that's what they've grown up in. That's what they understand. They understand that the audience that they're trying to appeal to. So, yeah, I went on my phone later and on some of the websites that I have, and I found the pictures of Mike out, and some of the pictures of Mike that you're talking about, and also him addressing the team, which was just great, as you well know, and I'm sure you've talked about how cool that was when he went out. He's asking us, what am I going to say? He's asking you, hey, you're the media guy. What do I say? And it was like, you'll be fine. And he was great when he went out there. Like, what would he expect from Mike Reed except greatness and everything that he does? And he was terrific when he talked to those. You could watch them. I was kind of looking in some of their faces. And once they realized, after James had Coach Franklin had read off his biography of and some of the highlights of the things that he's done, it was the look on their faces, and then they listened. They were, and I'm sure they do that anyway, because that's the way this coaching staff, you know, they want them to be attentive and they want them to be respectful. But I think Mike Reed brought that out, that they were listening and thinking, wow, this guy's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, that's what James said to me later. He says, how would you have introduced him? I said, there are 7 billion people on the planet. One has a Maxwell, a Grammy, and an Atwood.
Yeah, amen. Right, and also talking about how he's Joe's Renaissance man. And I remember those days, because right at the end when I was at Penn State, he had just come there, and that was a time when Joe had just taken over as head coach and was trying to bring in all these athletic people to turn them into defensive players and to try and hold the score down with speed on defense, and then to smash people in the mouth on offense and to win and use your kicking game. And I guess you have to say it was pretty successful for that man for a long time.
Yeah, it sure was. Not only that, when you walked in the stadium, you went through the tunnel, I know how much you enjoyed that, but you specifically went to the sideline on the same side as the press box. Explain to everybody why you did that.
Yeah, I had to tell you that, because it was kind of cool. When I was at Penn State, I worked at the student station WDFM my junior and senior years, and Jim Tarman, who we just recently lost, was a great man, was a sports information director. So he would take the sports director of the station, and they knew we would work for free, and he'd give you a job. So I had two jobs. One year I was a spotter for the visiting team, which was really neat, and another year I was the guy that stood on the sideline, and the producer would hang a little red flag out of the booth. And that meant I had to give a signal to the official. I would put my hand over my heart, and he would blow the whistle, point both ways, and call a timeout. Now, we were only on radio in those days, so there was hardly any television, so there weren't that many of them, and they didn't last as long. But it was the coolest feeling to stand there and have that kind of a power that I would look up there and see that red flag. Then the guy would pull the red flag in, kind of like we do now. You look down there and you see that guy in the hat and the headset and all the 20-yard line doing, with the TV timeouts. Well, I was the guy doing that, and I walked over to that spot about the 10-yard line, which was in line with a booth, or 15 or 20, whatever it was, and I looked back up there and I thought, I'm 72 years old right now. I was either 19 or 20 years old when I was standing on the sideline doing that. And all the stuff that has happened since then, and what a lucky guy I am, and how cool that was to be able to do something like that when I was such a young kid and have that kind of a memory. So, yeah, I did kind of stand there, and it was just me, just reliving it, because I thought, well, who cares? Who knows? And then I had to tell you.
Oh, no, I thought that was the neatest story. That's why I wanted to bring it up again. Baseball's 162 games. During the course of the year, between baseball, football, basketball, I'll do in the neighborhood of 100. If I have my class sitting there right now, as somebody who's used to doing 162 of those a year, how important would it be to tell them that each game has its own importance and don't pace yourself?
Oh, number one, look, I did 37 years on the air and was lucky enough to be part of an organization that was in 5 World Series and won 2 of them. And there were some other really brutal, bleak years, just awful, just seasons that you just wanted to forget about. But in all those brutal years and bleak seasons, I came to the ballpark every day with the idea that something may happen that I've never seen before. And also to think how lucky I was to be a person in there who had the job. It wasn't a job, but had the responsibility to do Phillies baseball and bring Phillies baseball to the large audience that we had and people that wanted to listen and watch. So I always regarded it every day. It wasn't a season to me. It was daily. The road trips, even on the days when you were exhausted, you know, you'd gotten in at 5 in the morning and you had to be out there and do it, you know, not play, but broadcast the games. Example today, I heard on the radio today, and I hadn't realized it, April 17th, 1976. Okay, I'm in Wrigley Field that day. And, you know, it looks like we got a decent team that year starting out in 76. And what happens that day? The Phillies are losing 12-1, and they wind up winning that game, and Mike Schmidt hits four consecutive home runs. Yeah. And, you know, you start looking stuff up. It's not like it is now where people can look it up. No National League player done that since 18-something. American League player had. But there you were, something that not only he had never seen before, but nobody had ever seen before. No one was alive right at that point, probably, that had seen it the last time that it happened. So there was a perfect example of going to the ballpark that day, Steve, and having something amazing occur right in front of you.
See, and that's something that happens. Somebody asked me, when do you like sit back and reflect a little bit? And I said, no, there's always one point in every game where at Beaver Stadium, for example, there's that area I can look out, I can see Mount Nittany, where I'll think to myself, how lucky am I to be sitting there? Like, that's every game.
Amen.
I think that.
And you can tell the way you do the game with your enthusiasm. Hey, look, I'm standing there the other day, and I'm asking you, okay, Where'd they block that kick that day? Where was that punt? Where was that field goal thing blocked? Where did that all start? Where that unbelievable situation occurred where Haley picked it up and you made that great call in the Ohio State game? I wanted to know that because as a fan, when I was there that day, that was one of the most exciting things I've ever seen in any sporting event I've ever attended. And I wanted to see where that was. Well, those are the little things that are ingrained in your memory, and you had no problem telling me exactly where that thing was blocked, where he picked it up, and where that darn holder almost ran him down.
Yeah, the single most athletic punter in America who was holding on the ball. I mean, maybe he's from Australia. Jeez. I'm telling you right now, they should have put him on the Australian Olympic team.
Well, that guy was flying, and he had the all-important angle, too, and he used it. Thank goodness he wasn't strong enough to spin him down on the five, because what we were kidding around about, we really didn't want to be first and go on the five against that team.
No. In fact, I think I said to you, in the Fiesta Bowl, when Saquon Barkley broke free on the 92-yard run, when he got to the 50-yard line, I said, goodbye, he is gone. Because, you know, you and I both know, you're sitting in the booth all those years, you know, wide angle, you can see he's got it, right?
Sure.
I looked at you and I said, on the Haley play, not one time did I say that until he got to the end zone.
No, you could tell it. You could tell when you heard the replay that you thought he had a heck of a chance for something big to happen here, but there was something occurring that could get in the way of that. And you and I were laughing about that because the box that I sit in, lucky enough to sit in around the 15 or 20, is down that sideline, down that side of the field. And I had an unbelievably perfect angle at watching this guy cutting off the angle and getting closer. And I thought, he's going to get to him. Now, can he tackle him or not? I don't know, but he's going to get to it. And darn if he doesn't spin him at the five. And thank goodness Grant Haley spun off him and went into the end zone, and then the party started.
Yeah. Oh, and the party started big time. I know there's only moments you can get up here and do things like this. I mean, is there a part that you and Renee can carve out and come up during the season this year?
Yes, for the Iowa game, October 27th.
Perfect.
In fact, I saw they're going to do – I think I've been to the whiteout the last 5 years, so I saw they're going to do the whiteout at the Ohio State game at the end of September. But, yeah, I'll be able to come up on October 27th and see the Iowa game. So I love to come up there one time a year, and lately it's been so cool to be able to come up twice as we were able to hang out with you over the weekend.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you know darn well, I think we could have done the rest of the show. Steve and Wheels just go back and forth. I'm sure there are a lot of people. Okay, a lot of people. How long did we have lunch? 2.5 hours?
Oh, yeah, we were there a long time. We covered a lot of subjects. You had a great line. When I said to you, we won't have anything to talk about. And you said, yeah, well, we won't be able to tell any of these stories we were just telling.
Some of the stories funny. That we told, it. No, we can't.
That was funny.
But I'll say this. We could have done, people would have loved to have been a fly on a wall for that. That was a lot of fun. My friend, thank you so much for carving out a few minutes for us today. I think the world of you. You know that. Highest respect, and can't ask for a better friend. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, Steve. You know, the feeling is mutual. And had a great time up there, and it was great to be able to hang out with you and talk football and baseball and other stuff. It was great.
I'll get this text, or I'll get an email, and it always starts out, Wheels from Bluebell to Steve from Lamont. So.
That's it. That's our handle. I'm not a Twitter guy, so that's my handle.
I'm not one either, despite the fact they make me have one. Sean will tell you I don't use it. So.
That's bad. Hey, listen, one last thing before we go. Big game tonight for your Red Sox. That's pretty cool. David Price against Shohei Ohtani.
Isn't the Ohtani thing amazing? I mean, look, because obviously you and I, you know, Babe Ruth was long gone, so that guy that could pitch, hit, whatever. In our lifetime, this is the first guy we've really seen like this.
It's amazing, too. And at the end of spring training, they were talking about they thought he was going to go to AAA. Said he wasn't going to make their club. And then he comes out and pitches. Then he hits homers in three straight games. It's one of those stories that you can't make it up. It's just unbelievable. So I know that game's going to start at 10, and I'll be darned. I'm going to stay up and watch some of it, because just to see Price and as hot as the Red Sox and the Angels are, and to maybe pitch a game where it's not – play a game in baseball right now where it's not snowing or everybody has hoods and parkas, it'll be really nice
to
watch a game
like that. It'll be fun to see a game with short sleeves.
Oh, geez. It's just been awful. Just awful. You know, awful month for baseball.
Well, everybody. I mean, that was the amazing part about Saturday, is that we were outside and it was, 80-plus degrees out. There's only been 2 days like that the whole year. We got one of them. I mean, I went to work today. I had my winter coat on again.
Yeah, it's awful. It is. Well, and you're dealing with a guy that had spent 2.5 months in Clearwater, so it just felt like a normal day to me being up there. I was thinking walking around that campus for a couple of days over the weekend on Friday and Saturday. I haven't felt it like this up here when I've come up there since I was a student. Because whenever I come up there, it's freezing, it seems like. So that was really fun. Yeah, I hope we get some baseball weather before long, because it's horrible to play these games in this weather, and it's tough for fans. And I think the industry appreciates the ones that are coming out right now, because it's not easy.
No, it's not. And not only that, but it looks like this weekend is going to be also great recruiting weather for football, basketball, recruiting weather.
Yes, it sounded like our mutual friends up there are very excited about this upcoming weekend with the type of young people they're going to attract to be able to come up. And hey, Blue White Weekend is special, and it does sound like it's going to be great. So I'll be tuned in. I'll be looking forward to hearing you and Jack. It's always fun to listen to it, especially that game, because it's so loose.
Oh, there's nothing on the line there, so it is loose. You can get more information. Although sometimes in a couple of those emails, you get more information than.
Well, I hope when you have a football season this year, I don't have to be texting you about rain delays. That was upset. That was a little different.
You know, the Michigan State game, how many times? You must have texted me 4 or 5 times, because if there's anybody on the planet that knows how to handle it, you got me through it.
Well, I had been through a few of those. You know, maybe some of your Spikes games, but there's nothing like our sport. The rain delay is all part of it. So, yeah, I learned how to do it. I became a voracious reader throughout the years.
Very much so. Wheels, thanks so much. What a pleasure, as always. Audience loves you. I think the world of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Anytime, I love to talk to you, so keep in touch.
During Hyundai's 4th of July sales event, celebrate America's birthday with America's best warranty and a whole lot of savings from Sunbury Motors Hyundai. If you want to have a fun day, you have to drive a Hyundai from Sunbury Motors Hyundai. Sunbury Motors Hyundai has 17 2017 new Hyundais that must go now. Sunbury Motors Hyundai has 6 2017 Hyundai Elantra Limiteds with savings over $6,000.
$6,000 off an Elantra Limited is huge.
Sunbury Motors Hyundai has 2017 Hyundai Sonatas with savings up to $6,144, starting at $18,666. Every Hyundai comes with America's best warranty, 10 years, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and Hyundai Assurance. If an SUV is more in your mind, 2017 Santa Fe Sports start at $22,576 with savings on Santa Fe's now up to $5,199. It's Hyundai's 4th of July sales event at Sunbury Motors Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburyhyundai.com.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia up on the strip, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. It's Best of Week, and Sean Carey here. Steve back next month, Monday. If you haven't subscribed to our Steve Jones Show podcast, when you do, after we air them live here on WKOK, the shows drop right to your smartphone and tablets. You can listen to them anytime, anywhere. So go to either your Apple Podcast app, if you have an iPhone or iPad, or go to Google Play. If you have a Samsung Galaxy, type in Steve Jones Show and subscribe to our podcast. And of course, it's free. And 3 months of shows always archived at stevejonesshow.com. Our Best of Week will continue tomorrow. Tony Knopp, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management and InviteManager.com, will join us. Richard Sandomir, the longtime sports media writer for the New York Times, doing that for close to 30 years, now the obituary writer for the Times, and he wrote a book about the movie The Pride of the Yankees on Lou Gehrig. We had that last summer after the hardcover book was released. A paperback version was just released back in the spring, a couple months ago. So we'll replay that with Stephen Richard Sandomir tomorrow. And then on Friday, Mike DeCourcy and Penn State football legend Mike Reed here for you on the show. Sports note, former Philadelphia Philly, part of the World Championship team 2008, and was also an All-Star in 2009, Jason Wirth of the Washington Nationals. He's not saying he is retiring from professional baseball, but he says he's done playing baseball. 39-year-old was a free agent in November 2017 by the Nationals. He signed with Seattle, signed a 7-year, $126 million contract with the Nationals in 2011, was roundly criticized being excessive for a player of that age, was 32 at the time. But Wirth helped, of course, the Phillies win that world championship in 2008. When he was with Washington, played with the Nats for 7 years, hit .263, 109 home runs. And more importantly, the Nationals made the playoffs 4 times after not going to the postseason at all at their first 7 seasons in Washington, D.C. By the way, the Phillies will crank up another series with the Nats tomorrow night. That'll be the start of a 4-game weekend set at Citizens Bank Park. But first off, in their way tonight will be the New York Yankees. The Phillies looking to avoid a sweep tonight against the Yankees. Right-hander Zach Eflin has won 4 times here in June, so he'll attempt to stay perfect tonight. He'll get the ball for the Phillies, and airtime with On Deck 6:30 this evening on 1070 AM. Scott Fransky and Larry Anderson will have the call beginning at 7:05. Villanova and Michigan played for the College Basketball National Championship back in April, and this guy had a courtside seat. Always great when we have him on the Steve Jones Show from the Detroit Free Press, Chris Soleri.
Yeah, good to join you guys. How are you doing today?
Doing well. All right. I had said yesterday to somebody that asked me about Villanova, Michigan, I said, here's the problem. I said, Michigan's going to need at least 75 to win. They can't get there. That's unusual to say about a Michigan team. What did you think watching it last night?
Yeah, Villanova is just so deep. I mean, you know, you saw they shut down Jalen Brunson, and I think it was the first time in 45 games he hadn't reached double digits in scoring.
Right.
But they've got the sixth man coming off the bench, and DiVincenzo is playing above the rim, shooting from outside, had no counter to that. I mean, you know, I think that Michigan team was just it was not as deep as the Villanova team. I think that's one thing, but I thought Villanova made some great adjustments on Bogner after the first maybe 9 minutes of the game. I mean, he had 11 points in the first 9 minutes, and then they held him scoreless for the rest of the half, and I think he only finished with 16. So, I mean, when Michigan doesn't get scoring from Bogner, and when he didn't get scoring from Charles Mathis like they did throughout the whole tournament, they struggle to find offensive answers. And, I mean, you know, it probably went a little bit. I had it tag at 10. I figured Villanova. I mean, they did a good job early defensively, Michigan did on them. But, you know, once they caught rhythm, once DiVincenzo's heated up, there was no way Michigan was going to stop that train.
Obviously, Jay Wright went through a streak, well, it was one season, but 6 years ago he was 13-19. And then he changed a little bit. You know, I mean, you know, he got to a Final Four 9, but 6 years ago he was 13-19. So he felt he had to make changes. What's it like watching a team, Chris, that can put 5 3-point shooters on the floor at the same time?
Well, I mean, we've seen it at times with that Michigan team, that Michigan program that D-line has. Maybe not at this one. I think Xavier Simpson maybe is a weak link in terms of being able to hit outside, but he creates so many things for other guys, different kind of point guards than maybe D-line has previously had. But, boy, I mean, you know, Bridges can step out. Pascal has great time. And I thought that he was a difference maker in that first night against Kansas. And, you know, he hit a couple against Michigan. I mean, it seems like whenever they had guys that would score, it wasn't like Villanova was scoring a random bucket here and there from different guys. Those guys would get in a rhythm. They would get 2 or 3 buckets and then pass the torch to the next guy. And that's hard to overcome. And, you know, I think Pascal in particular, he hit a 3 from the corner and then drove to the bucket around Wagner, the next guy. I mean, how do you defend that? I mean, how do you defend that when you've got a 6'8 guy or so that steps out like that and drives to the basket? Well, Michigan, you know, Michigan got used to that with Wagner at 6'11. But without Wagner, they don't have that other guy to do that. It just seems like they brought waves off the bench for Villanova in that game yesterday.
Which then brings us to the next part. An area where John Beilein and Michigan have received a lot of credit this year is that we all know that John offensively is brilliant. He has options off of options, and that's one of the reasons why he rarely calls timeouts during the game, because he is always thinking about that. But it was their defense that made such a big difference for them this year. Now let's flip it to the other side. We always talk about Villanova's offense and the threes. What did you think of Villanova's defense?
I thought Villanova's defense, like after that first 9 minutes, really ratcheted it up. You know, I think there was maybe a little bit of, I don't want to say deer in headlights, because I think that's too experienced of a team and, you know, guys that have been on that stage. But I think some of the things that Michigan was doing maybe caught them off guard in game speed. And that's, you know, both of those teams are tough one-day prep teams, I think.
Yes.
But once they did make those adjustments, probably, like I said, around that 10-minute mark, 11-minute mark of the first half, Michigan couldn't get into any of their sets. And Beilein talked about that after the game. Their defense was blowing up their action, trying to get Wagner free, get him looks off the dribble, and they were in their grill. You know, the guards got pushed out. They couldn't swing the ball like Michigan teams usually do. That length and athleticism of Villanova cut passing lanes off. And, you know, it's amazing because Michigan had been such a good ball-moving team all throughout the Big Ten tournament, all throughout that big run that they've made from maybe, like, early February on. But they couldn't do it. You know, when you can't move the ball, you watch their offense all of a sudden start to stagnate. You know, what it reminded me of is when Michigan State this year would go into funks like that. And we hadn't seen that from this Michigan team in months, but that's what happens when you play a quality opponent like that.
How fascinated were you by the Sister Jean angle on the Final Four?
Well, you know, I got to sit in on the press conference, which was pretty amazing. You know, they put together a ramp to get her up on her wheelchair, and, you know, from what I understand, I mean, she just recently, not too long ago, had a fall that required her to get in a wheelchair. She's been pretty up and mobile. I mean, for a 98-year-old, she's certainly intuitive and insightful. The way March Madness gets, you know, you always see something like that just gets overplayed and beaten into the ground. But this was at least one thing where you could look at it and you'd see the good, and, you know, you could see the fact that not just those players, but that whole Loyola community rallied around her and trust her as kind of their emotional and spiritual center. I read that she lives in the dorms with the kids still. So, I mean, she's an integral part of that university, and it was, you know, having known Drew Valentine for a number of years, one of their assistant coaches, he said that when he was interviewing last Memorial Day, that she met her, or she met with him and started talking some X's and O's. So, I mean, she was a sharp, sharp lady. I mean, it was neat. It was a neat story to kind of get us through the early part of that tournament and even down to the Final Four. I mean, as good as that Loyola story was in itself, I mean, that really added some heart to it.
And you've got 18 to 22-year-olds from all different backgrounds. After every game, they go up and hug her. And you know what really impressed me is that I saw the Michigan players do that after the semifinal game. That showed me something.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, that John Beilein is a class guy, and his players are class guys, too. I think that's, you know, that's been evident for a number of years. But that was a special moment. I think Jordan Poole saw a picture of him going up and giving her a hug. I mean, you know, that she's talked about that during her little media availability, which really stunned her, that she actually had a room full of reporters wanting to talk to her. You know, she wants to root a little harder for Loyola, but she also doesn't want to see anybody get injured, and she wants the other team to do well as well. So, I mean, it's what sports is supposed to be about.
Chris, it's going to be interesting now to see, because I think most people expect Wagner to get himself out there. Rockman, of course, will be gone. Bridges and Jackson both have done the expected. They're going out. Tony Carr is. Corey Sanders is. Jackson at Maryland is. Four senior starters at Purdue, of course, have to. How different could the league be next year, or do you think it's the pecking order is still relatively close?
Well, we saw, it was top-heavy this year. I think it's probably going to be top-heavy, but it's going to be a different feel with all that talent on. And, you know, you replace it, but I don't necessarily know if you have that kind of star power right now with the guys that are leaving. I mean, you know, Corey Sanders make Rutgers relevant. I mean, they were a tough,
that's right,
tough draw anytime they play. And Tony Carr was kind of such a glue guy when he was on the court for Penn State, and, you know, they had a lot of talent around them. That's another guy that really was kind of the engine for a team. And you lose Bridges and Jackson at Michigan State, maybe Nick Ward. That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of production for Michigan State to lose. But, I mean, you're talking about a program that replaces kids with five-star kids. And I think Beilein has the best class coming in recruiting-wise, a deep group. They'll likely lose Wagner. It'll be interesting to see what Charles Matthews' decision is now coming out of this tournament run, that maybe his stock is as high as it ever has been. Maybe kind of reminds me a little maybe of Glenn Robinson a couple years ago when he had to make the choice. So, it's going to be a different vibe. But maybe that'll allow some of the other teams like Penn State with most of the core intact or even in Nebraska that snuck up this year to kind of sneak back into that, you know, go from the 5-6, you know, in that range all the way up to the Big Ten championship. But so hard to tell, because I think there's still going to be a lot of movement, especially now with all the grad transfers. That should change.
Yes, everything. That changes everything. I mean, that's your waiver wire. I mean, it's a waiver wire. One final question before I let you go. If I were to sit you down in front of the Rice Commission, what would be a couple of elements that you would stress to them about college basketball and about student athletes?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if I can't get rid of the block charge rule, which I think
you and I feel the same about the block charge thing. I'm sick of it.
Listen, there are plenty of offensive fouls on the books that you can get rid of guys just standing around being unathletic and rewarded for that.
Right.
But that's neither here nor there. This is a bigger deal. I mean,
that's right.
The grad transfer thing, I think, is a big thing, because it is like an open market right now. I don't like the idea of you know, restriction-free transfers, because that will ultimately change the entire construct of college athletics. I don't think you can do that in just college basketball without having that have a trickle-down effect into every other sport and every other school and every other program. There are so many things. You know, I think you gotta do something. You have to work in concert with the NBA to get rid of this one and done. And I've always been a proponent and believer of the baseball rule, that let these guys go play in the D League, let them go play overseas, let them go play in the NBA out of high school if they want. But if you sign a letter of intent, that should be bound for 2 to 3 years at least. I mean, it works so well in baseball. You know, guys get on campus. You know, you can redshirt a year, and then you can leave after your your third year as a redshirt sophomore, or you can play 3 years and leave after your junior year, test the process. Maybe it's a situation where college basketball takes the baseball model, lets these guys get drafted. If they don't come to a term, they come back. Or even a hockey model where you can be drafted and your rights are retained. The only difference in those sports is that there are far more guys that proliferate systems. So
right.
this is a challenging thing. I mean, Mark Emmert talked a lot about that this week, last week now, here in San Antonio. But I think that they're expecting to have their findings and their recommendations done, I think, the end of this month, somewhere around April 24th. So there's much smarter people than me on that commission, that's for sure.
Well, I know that.
But I think those are some of the. Well,
I know that with me.
Pretty given.
I know that with me. I mean, you're smarter than I am, so believe me.
Well, like I said, I think there just needs to be some more uniformity to what is going on here, and you know, the NBA needs to get on board with this as well, because you know the players' union is seeing guys that just basically go to college just to play basketball and don't even finish a year of college, and not even one and done. I mean, let's face it, these guys, once they get to the end of their freshman year, bounce classes, and they're not going to get an education. And that's got to be a component that everybody needs to watch. The NBA needs those kind of guys.
Right. Well, and, you know, look, biggest element, two words, come up with something that has some common sense.
Yeah. I mean, look at Jalen Brunson. Jalen Brunson's about to get his degree in 3 years.
3 years.
And, you know, he could have been a one-and-done or two-and-done guy.
Right.
You know, but, of course, now he's also eligible to grad transfer, but...
Right.
I'm thinking he's going to grad transfer to the pay level rather than the
he's going to
the table level.
He's going to go from the Nova 4-letter level to the 3-letter level. Okay.
Yep.
All right, Chris. Thanks so much. It's always great talking with you. Appreciate the perspective on everything. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Have a great summer. If we don't talk soon.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.